Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Mel Buchanan, the Rosemary Curator of Decorative Arts and Design at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Today we're talking about a beautiful new book from NOMA, Glass, Sand, Ash, Heat. Mel Buchanan is the Rosemary Curator of Decorative Arts and Design at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Today we're talking about a beautiful new book from NOMA, Glass, Sand, Ash, Heat. Mel, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's an honor to be here.
It's so nice to see you again, and especially about this beautiful book. So you're the curator of, among many other things, 5,000 glass objects that belong to the museum. What a responsibility.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a collection that's ranging from some of the earliest artworks that we care for at NOMA, so mm-hmm. Egyptian beads, but all the way up to artworks that anyone can experience in the sculpture garden. We have a glass bridge you could come and see for free with your family. So it's a really an astounding range of objects that are glass in NOMA's collection. Which might be a great way to introduce this, because I am a one mere mortal. I can't possibly understand 4,000 years of art and science and food and all of the ways that this glass collection can be interpreted. Mm-hmm. So we brought together a team of people to really think about glass at NOMA.
And you do it in so many different ways. I mean, there's one essay about glass in the science laboratory, for example, that's so fascinating.
Yeah, we turn to a New Orleans area chemist, Alex Sanchez, who spoke about glass from a way I don't think about it. For him, it's a tool for doing a chemical experiment. But we also would want to think about those who make glass. So Gene Koss, who founded the glass program at Tulane University, he spoke to me from the artist's perspective. But we also are thinking from other parts of the museum. So glass is used in our photography department. Ingrid Saib, our objects conservator, she takes care of glass. But then also looking outside the museum, glass is part of food history and wine history. So looking around to see who in New Orleans could think about glass as part of New Orleans history, but also part of that dining culture. And the list went on of different ways of thinking about this material that touches on science, art.
And think about the pharmacy museum, too.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we actually have some pieces of glass in another exhibition about the Prohibition era on loan from the pharmacy museum.
So it's a lot.
It is.
But it's also very fragile. So how do you care for something that's really, like those beads, for example?
At the most basic level, the museum's job is to keep everything secure and unbroken and unchanged. Mm-hmm. So with glass, yes, there are some special challenges. It's having the right people trained to handle things for when we have to move them. And we try to keep the relative temperature and humidity stable over mm-hmm. time. That's kind of the best thing you can do to protect artworks from fluctuations or spikes in temperature, which we all know we have so often here in New Orleans. So the past, say, 30, 40 years have given us better technologies to protect against those historical spikes. But we also have trained people who have that scientific training to be able to understand what's happening at a material level. Mm-hmm. I don't have that side of things, but I know who to call. And that was part of this book, really looking into not only the conditions that glass can change over time, say crizzling and deteriorating as certain, as my non-science brain understands it, alkalis are leaving the glass. Different humidities and fluctuations can cause it to crumble.
So talk about crizzling. That's one of my favorite words that I learned reading this book.
Crizzling in the glass can happen over a time, over a short amount of time or 1,000 years of time. And it's when the material of the glass, when exposed to different humidity levels or different environment, the structure of it degrades so that you have a network. It could look like lace if you're being generous, or spider web of network. And it can cause the entire glass to structurally collapse into a pile of sand. But sometimes, and we have this on view in the exhibition, the glass will still retain its structure and it will look cloudy. So a piece of art that used to be crystal clear has this network of minuscule little cracks in it that makes it look cloudy from a distance. But when you get up close, you really are starting to learn a little bit about the complexity of that material. Glass that is in some ways very simple. It's just sand, ash, a little bit of lime, and a whole lot of heat, but has been interpreted in different recipes through time in so many different ways that it can be incredibly complicated to understand the material.
The recipe for glass. I love to think of that. So talk about some of the logistical challenges of mounting an exhibit like this. There's one chandelier, for example, that is a striking piece.
Right.
That was a logistical nightmare, I think, probably for you.
You walk right into the show, and it was the anchor to the show, both for how it looks, but some of the ideas it gave us. But it's a 7-foot-tall chandelier, thousands of pieces that also have electrical components moving within them. It's an artwork by Fred Wilson, an internationally known American artist. And this is the first time we've presented this artwork at NOMA, but we will keep it on view. It won't go away in storage after this particular show is done. But yes, but it took 4 members of our team a week to put this together, carefully labeling everything and
like putting a puzzle together.
Exactly.
And it's unusual partly because it's black glass.
So exactly. This artwork by Fred Wilson introduces some of the complexity of looking at art. And he's a contemporary artist that has turned this medium, glass, and this object, a chandelier, to shed light on whose stories haven't been told, perhaps through art history. So he's looking here at the tradition of Venetian glass, specifically on the island of Murano in Venice. And he was the artist for the Venice Biennale, a huge art show.
Sure.
And he's there in this city that for thousands of years has been an exchange place for goods, people, ships coming through, ideas and science fermenting. And then he looks at the art history of Venice and the palazzos and the paintings. And he's not seeing anyone that looks like him, a Black American artist. Mm-hmm. But knowing the truth of history is that the presence of Africans in Venice, really throughout all ports of trade and commerce and throughout Europe, has always been there, but is not reflected in the art history. So by taking this symbol of glass as an exchange, but as a chandelier, as a kind of a luxury item that hangs in palaces across the world, and simply making it black glass is a really profound comment. Because we've all seen chandeliers. What color are they usually? Clear, white, sometimes a color, but rarely do you see glass in black. So you're automatically looking at it and thinking, I'm seeing something different here. Mm-hmm. And then you ask the next question, why? And that color choice of black is allowing the artist to kind of point to these stories, but it also connects to art history and ideas of memento mori, of the choice of black is usually reminding us of the beauty and frailty of life, kind of brings in those existential ideas that we all have to grapple with.
And speaking of how we look at art like this, let's talk a little bit about the work of art that's on the cover and how you chose it. And it looks one way on the cover and another way you see it in whole in the book.
I love that you've pointed out how the scale of an object and the beauty of modern photography can allow us to even think about it a little deeper. What we're looking at is a 5-inch tall glass vanity bottle by the French artist Maurice Morinot, made in the 1920s. But we took a photo of it that's zoomed in to look at the body of the glass. So on the cover, I can't remember sometimes if I'm looking at a 5-inch vanity bottle in glass, or am I looking through a microscope at the cellular structure of life? Or am I looking through a telescope at the heavens, at the, you know, the surface of the moon? But keep in mind, all of those things, both a microscope and a telescope, also relying on glass. So I love playing with that idea.
But, and is it old or is it new?
Exactly. I mean, it looks... Is it natural? Is it man-made? And that's really kind of getting to one of the central ideas of this project is glass is all of those things. It can be natural. It is man-made. It is both extraordinary, but also ordinary. You may have had your orange juice with a glass this morning, but then also you're toasting life's greatest moments with rare champagne or, you know, it's exquisite.
Sure.
It's breakable. It's also common. Kind of all of these. It's not this or that. It's this and that. So throughout history.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Mel Buchanan, the Rosemary Curator of Decorative Arts and Design at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Today, we're talking about her beautiful new book, Glass, Sand, Ash, Heat. Before the break, Mel was talking about one of the featured artists, Maurice Morinot.
But this artist in the 1920s France, he was making a really radical paint canvases, letting kind of the paint be about an emotional experience with the French artists we call the fauves or wild beasts. But then he turned to glass. He left paint and started doing this with glass. And it's really an exceptional moment in the history of this material where glass, which isn't something in the making phase you think of as tactile or touching, like it's a really complicated technology. You're blowing at the end of a tube. It's not something like clay or paint where an artist can touch it and manipulate it. But that is what Maurice Morinot is thinking through. He's looking at his role as the artist and how he can express something through this kind of untouchable medium at the making phase. But he writes about it so eloquently. He's speaking about being an artist, working with flames and tears in his eyes and soot in his face and taking his breath and putting it into this glass object. So he's really speaking about, or as I think of it, a conceptual idea that this glass vanity bottle is more than a place to hold perfume. This glass vanity bottle has captured the breath of the artist or the breath of humanity. And what a beautiful intellectual kind of leap that is that art takes in the 20th century. It's not simply a matter of being beautiful, which it often is, or telling a story, which it can do, but it's something else. It's trying to use artwork, whether it's painting, sculpture, or a glass vanity bottle, to capture an idea or an essence or a feeling about humanity. And that is really a simplified way of thinking about what art does in the 20th century, to be this medium that, you know, inspires us all still. It's a different way of thinking about the human experience. And Maurice Morinot is catching it in a glass bottle.
And there's that beautiful blaze of color in this object, too, that makes it so beautiful.
So Maurice Morinot is taking this medium that for thousands of years by this point, humans had been trying to make delicate or clear or control it to get rid of the impurities of the sand that might make glass gray or brown or with a little bit of green. You can kind of imagine what that might look like in glass to make it perfect clear. This is an artist who lets those impurities of the sand be part of the expression, be beautiful. The flaws really are beautiful. And instead of making it delicate, he makes it chunky and sturdy. And instead of making it perfect, so there are no air bubbles within that glass, he purposefully captures air bubbles. So you have strains of color of browns and greens and blues that are coming from little chemicals in the sand, but really make it very compelling. And it's marbled through with little pockets of air. And it's just kind of reminding you that this material is coming from sand and the fire to make this material. And it really makes it a little more visual, being able to see all of those impurities and celebrate them.
Well, one of the things you include in this book is an interview you did with Gene Koss, who is a wonderful glass artist who has taught many, many students at Tulane about glass blowing. Describe, if you would, that glass blowing studio, because I think nothing is more humbling than to stand in that heat and hear it and see it.
New Orleans is very lucky to have such a well-established and well-regarded art in glass program. So I love how Gene Koss, you know, he would use that term art in glass. It's about the technical side of being able to make this material do what you want as an artist, but the art comes first. So it was really interesting for me in speaking to him, because I was trying to think he would bring to the project sort of the technical side. Like, tell me about the tools, tell me about the selection. But he was talking about drawing and ideas and concepts. So another of the artworks that we have in our collection, it's called Ridge Road Climb. It's beautiful and it's abstract. But to him, it was a real story about an artist, or really any of us in our vocation, overcoming life's hurdles, like a biker might have to overcome a hill. And if you start to look at the glass, like, ah, yes, there is kind of a hill motif, the ridge road climb. So it's about the idea first and how it looks. You know, if it ends up beautiful in the end, you know, maybe that's the bonus. But it was about making an object that captures a story that an artist wants to tell.
And lung power.
And lung power heat and endurance. Yes. And risk. I mean, when you're in the glass shop, things can go wrong. You know, things
break. It's so hot.
You've invested, the value of the heat to warm everything up, and the materials and the labor and the people and all of the teamwork. And it could go wrong pretty quickly. So a lot of guts to be a glass artist.
Oh, I think great strength. Great strength. And heat tolerance. What was so interesting to think about for me, I'm sure you think about all the time, are the ties that New Orleans has to glass. Yeah. And there's so many when you think about them.
We try to do that with all of our projects at the New Orleans Museum of Art, whether we're talking about ancient Egyptian history to, of course, with contemporary art. There's always a meaningful way to bring it home to New Orleans. So for, you know, one of the ways, I just became so charmed and fascinated by the bead necklaces.
Yes.
Like at NOMA in the Sidney and Walda Bestoff Sculpture Garden, we celebrate this tradition of glass beads in New Orleans with a larger-than-life version by the French artist Jean-Michel Othoniel. But then I started looking around and, you know, I'll be out with my family and my kids, and what's the ultimate prize when you're standing on the parade route? Catching glass beads.
Right.
Not the plastic beads, but the glass beads. And so really kind of digging into, you know, the history of that tradition here in New Orleans. But then also looking around, you know, we brought to this project different perspectives of thinking about glass. And one I might want to mention is Zella Palmer, who heads the material culture program at Dillard University. And she was thinking about the food and drink culture here in New Orleans. But she's telling stories of women whose experiences aren't recorded and as often in letters, but she was walking through storage at the museum and she could link, say, oh, well, I'm just looking at a champagne glass. This may not be the exact one, but this might be the type of champagne glass that they were toasting in Storyville. Or she saw a little flower globe that was a souvenir object from the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893. And she's really, you know, there was a New Orleans woman who was a chef that was celebrated at that fair. So she's making all of these really interesting links to objects coming from different places with different backgrounds, but they connect here to New Orleans. And I thought she just put that together in a very poetic way. New Orleans is the center of the world. Yes.
Of course. And then, of course, you have the Mardi Gras Indian beads.
And then, yes, you cannot talk about glass in New Orleans with going to that minuscule level of the beads. And I admit at the beginning, I was thinking of glass as punch bowls and goblets and like, oh, yes, of course, the beads, the Mardi Gras Indians, the black masking tradition, mm-hmm. are these little beads. So I turned to NOMA's curator of African art, Amanda Maples, who partnered with New Orleans lawyer and Mardi Gras Indian chief, Dow Edwards, and they wrote the most poetic essay about beading tradition. Of course, looking here in New Orleans, but connecting it to African diasporic beadwork and to mm-hmm. indigenous American beadwork, but more so than kind of pointing to the formal connections, imagery, technique, they were looking at this idea that beads are tiny, insignificant on their own. They're meaningless. You lose them, but you string them together. You invest the bead with care, community, time, and it becomes a story. It becomes valuable. And I just loved it. It became like almost a parable for life. Like,
sure,
all of us are minuscule individual little beads on our own, but together we become powerful and strong. And they were seeing that in these beadwork traditions.
And talk about some of the West African crowns that were beaded.
I love how, you know, looking at this idea of beads allowed us to connect all these different parts of NOMA's collection. Mm-hmm. Indigenous beadwork, but then we have such a strong Arts of Africa collection where beadwork is, you know, critical. So, you know, one really impressive crown that we have on view in the museum's display of African art by a Yoruba artist, you know, has these beads hanging down, and you see it and it's beautiful in person, but then you imagine it in motion and you can almost hear the sound that the beads would make as they're, you know, being danced and worn in an environment mm-hmm. of people. So it's just a really exceptional artwork that it was such a pleasure to bring into this glass show, which ranges from artworks like this to punch bowls and bridges and large scale glass artwork. It allowed us to range everywhere over the museum collection.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Mel Buchanan, the Rosemary Curator of Decorative Arts and Design at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Today, we're talking about her beautiful new book, Glass, Sand, Ash, Heat. Isn't it kind of humbling for you as a curator to look at these fragile, ancient things and think how they've survived? And glass, most of all, being so fragile.
It's amazing how much survives from ancient times. You know, and a lot of it is spent a lot of its time underground, so protected in like burial sites or, you know, other excavation sites is how we get so much information from the ancients. And something we talk about in the book is glass over time with exposure to like acidic soil will change color. So it may have been originally mm-hmm. clear or a pale green, but that exposure to the acidity, it gets like this gorgeous, lustrous, rainbow metallic hue that we go gaga over in the 20th and 21st century because it's so beautiful. And that degradation of the glass, really what it is, has inspired artists. So when you think of an artist like Louis Comfort Tiffany, and he was innovating this gold swirled with rainbow glass at the turn of the century, he's emulating glass that's coming out of the ground from ancient eras that has done that naturally. And then we get into another discussion, you know, with the conservation team. If I brought in a piece of metal that was all rusty, first thing we would want to do is you want to get rid of that rust so you can see the original object. Mm-hmm. But if you bring in a piece of glass that has the, you know, metallic sheen to it, you could easily clean that off, but you wouldn't dare because we consider it beautiful. It's a subjective choice that we're mm-hmm. making in the museum about what kind of age is considered beautiful and what kind of age we would want to remove to show the original object.
I think you have one of the most fun jobs in the world.
We're very lucky in museums to be surrounded by not only beautiful objects, but ones that make you think. And then people coming through our doors, colleagues and visitors that think about them in new, different ways. What an exciting job to be able to learn throughout your entire life about those artworks that our ancestors have left behind for us to think about and contemplate.
To look at beautiful things. To look at beautiful things all day. Ah. We've been talking with Mel Buchanan, Rosemary Curator of Decorative Arts and Design at NoMA. Glass, Sand, Ash, Heat is on view at the New Orleans Museum of Art now until February 10th. Mel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Yvonne Spear Perrette signs her children's book, The Little Float That Could, Saturday, January 4th from 11 to 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. The second edition of Monique Verdun's gorgeous book, Return to Yachtney Chito, Home of Migrations, is back in print, and the Neighborhood Story Project is ready to celebrate it, jumpstarting 2025. Saturday, January 4th from 6 to 9, there will be a book release at the Autocrat Social and Pleasure Club on St. Bernard Avenue. This is a ticketed event. The Guild of Wizardry and Whimsy discusses Spinning Silver by Naomi Novik. Tuesday, January 7th at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Irvin Weathersby Jr. discusses and signs In Open Contempt, Confronting White Supremacy in Art and Public Space. Tuesday, January 7th at 6, Baldwin & Company. Tara Roberts discusses and signs Written in the Water, a memoir of history, home, and belonging. Thursday, January 9th at 6 at Baldwin & Company, another ticketed event. Brandon Jensen and Stephanie Inslow Herschenau, authors of A New Introduction to Sarah Orne Jewett's The Country of Pointed Furs, discuss that new edition Thursday, January 9th from 6 to 7:30 at Octavia Books. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.